It is Saturday, February 14th, 2015. Happy Valentine's Day. We're broadcasting live from Santa Cruz on the central coast of California. This is KUSP Public Radio 88.9 and KUSP.org. And ladies and gentlemen, it is time now for Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, coupling geeks and the rest of humanity. That's a little Valentine's Day nod there. Please keep in mind that the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP or any of the Geeks affiliated organizations. Hello, I'm Bonnie Jean Primsch in the host chair today, feeling a little hoarse still after my chest cold. And with me in the studio is Lyle Troxell, a photographer, programmer, and father.
Hello.
And after a long absence, so glad to see you back, Lindsay Lonnie, systems analyst and web programmer.
Good morning.
Good morning, good morning, good morning. Well, lots to talk about this morning. And let's talk about something that just happened, the Summit on Cybersecurity and Consumer Protection.
Yeah, yesterday President Obama was in Palo Alto, and I used to work over there, so it was exciting for me to hear. He was meeting with leaders of the tech community to discuss cybersecurity and consumer protection. And this was sort of prompted by that thing that happened with Sony a while back, as
right.
You probably heard about.
Okay, yeah.
So some of the topics that they were going to go over include improving online authentication methods and payment technologies, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of the focus seemed to be on improving communication between private sector and public government. Which is kind of a hot topic.
That is a hot topic because there are those who say, gee, if there were more cooperation, then things like this wouldn't happen. And there are others who say, get your fingers out of my pie.
Right. And, you know, a lot of the big companies were left with a bad taste in their mouths after the NSA,
right.
And the WikiLeaks thing and finding out that a lot of their consumer information had to be turned over to the government and, you know, they were mandated to do it.
Yeah.
So it is a hot topic. But like you said, most people agree that communicating about the details of cyber attacks could help prevent them. A lot of cyber attacks use the same technologies and or variations of the same technologies.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So some of the things that private sector leaders are concerned about are things like sharing information with the government might contain consumer data and might compromise consumers' trust in the
sure,
companies.
Sure, yeah.
And some firms also, excuse me, fear damage to their reputations if sharing breach details increases attention to an incident.
Oh, so if there's a somebody takes advantage of their system and cracks something, if they share that, that derails trust as well.
Right.
Well, that was a big part of the NSA hullabaloo too. Is companies like Google falling over themselves trying to be as transparent as they were allowed to be to show that they're not the bad guy, quote unquote.
Right. And some companies, when they've had breaches, have tried to keep it on the down low a little as much as possible because it's bad PR. But it just depends on the company and whether they prefer to be more transparent or not transparent.
Sure.
But
mm-hmm.
where it aligns as far as laws or, things like that. So
it's interesting. So the earlier part, you mentioned the idea that governments asking for data could potentially also has the same kind of effect, where information about a user could be put in the public record or at least known in other ways. And that is similar to some hacker grabbing it and distributing it if it's not done well. So
mm-hmm.
there's a lot of issues around even a pretty valid request, even a court subpoena for records. We see sometimes a court will say, we want all the information on people on this IP address. And it's a mail server and it's everybody, right? And so the company has to go, wait a second, are you looking for a specific person? We'll try to find a specific person because we don't want to get general data out there.
Yeah,
and
it is
complicated.
Right. So any word on the results of that summit, where they wound up with some of those issues?
Well, the consensus among tech leaders is that it's up to the government to create laws that allow pertinent info about cyber attacks to be shared without putting the companies at risk for legal action from states and individuals or losing consumer trust and profit.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the government is pressing for opt-in guidelines.
Right.
You
don't want to be responsible for creating the change.
Yeah, exactly.
That's what I'm hearing. You do it. No, you do it.
Yeah.
What is interesting, because if you don't have a mandated rule on what to do, every company's going to make up their own rule. And some are going to do a good job and some aren't. And, you know, if a company decides, well, we're going to be more transparent, they actually might get punished for that more transparency. So
mm-hmm.
there's a definite, competitive advantage potential there that if you put a mandated law, it's very clear the boundary is everybody plays the same rules.
Right. Sort of, it's sort of like, hey, government says I got to do this. Don't
right.
yell at me.
Right. And everybody's going to have to do it. So it's not. I'm not going to be an outlier here saying that, yeah, your data was stolen from us.
So it seems safer from a business standpoint to have the law in place because then they can kind of lean on that as the bad guy, let's say.
Right. But the other side of that is that businesses also don't want the government having their hands in it too much. You know, they don't want the government to be able to step in and say, hand over all your data. You know, it doesn't matter what it is.
They want
just enough regulation to cover themselves, but not so much that they're, you know, slave to whatever the government
tells
them.
And in that they're like any other big industry, like the car industry, that is sort of pushing back against, you know, imposed governmental standards to dictate where their R&D dollars should go, for instance.
Right, and basically what they're saying as first steps is that a rewriting of the outdated 80s-era Computer Fraud and Abuse Act would be a good step in the right direction, and that a federal data breach notification law that creates a consistent national standard would be helpful, because right now 48 states have laws like that, but they're all different. So if there's a data breach, the company has to figure out how to release information and notify customers in 48 different ways in order to cover themselves legally.
Oh my God.
So they want federal laws for that.
Not state ones, even.
Let's
go federal. Yeah.
So I knew about the summit, of course. I've heard a little bit about it. There's been some quotes from Obama in it and kind of discussion in general about these issues. Mm-hmm. And one of the stories I got from, it's actually AP News, delivered, you know, call for public debate over encryption is one of the standard news stories that's happening.
Yeah.
And one of the quotes in there is a little frustrating because though it's kind of true, it's not exactly true. And so I wanted to bring it up in the same light of the story, that Apple's iMessage platform, the news story says, Apple's iMessage platform, for example, offers end-to-end encryption text messages, unlike traditional text messaging. That encryption likely means that the only way police can see those messages is by obtaining a user's iPhone. And Apple has sold hundreds of millions of devices that use iMessage. Mm-hmm. So all that is relatively true, except that the way iMessage actually does the handshake protocol of the trust certificates of, like, if Lindsay and I want to talk to each other and we both want to encrypt, we have to get each other's encrypted public key for the other file, right? And we have to get them. And the way that we get those is we ask Apple for it. And Apple theoretically hands me Lindsay's and hands Lindsay mine. Mm-hmm. And then I encrypt with Lindsay's and only she can unencrypt it. That's a standard public-private key pairing.
Okay.
But the problem is the trust involved there is Apple in the middle. Apple could theoretically give me a key that they made that says Lindsay, but really it's our copy of Lindsay, and they keep Lindsay's, and I never would know that because of the way iMessage works. So yes, it's true, it's potentially end-to-end encryption. There is a man-in-the-middle attack potential if you don't trust Apple. If Apple got a subpoena, it would be forced to do that, they could do that. And so,
well, that's true also of like 1Pass or LastPassword or, you know, all those.
Well, those are a little different. But if I were to actually use a different piece of text messaging software with Lindsay, and she and I saw each other and took pictures of each other's certs, public certs, in each other's company, then there is no trust involved.
Mm-hmm.
But the trick about this is that that sentence seems to make a foundational thing that iMessage is encrypted end to end without the detail that if you trust Apple.
Right.
And that detail is so complicated. Like what I just described to you, I do a pretty good job of describing it. It's still kind of like, well, why is it? How can they do that?
Yeah, they're still.
And then also after Lindsay and I have a connection, I don't know if Apple can revoke it and assert after the fact. So that depends on their protocol, which is all closed source software. So again, it trusts whether you trust Apple's software.
And so you're using that as an example of trusting the middleman as kind of like an issue that needs to be resolved when we're talking about feeling secure using cybersecurity.
Yeah, I think the reason why I'm bringing it up is that even in the article claiming for more transparency in public debate over encryption, which Obama's calling for and which the summit kind of talked about, the level of complexity of encryption is such that it's hard for most people to grasp it. And therefore, having a public debate is kind of about, oh, well, we should have more things like iMessage. When in reality, from a technical perspective, that's the wrong way to do it. It's just better than other alternatives. So the debate, how do you get it to such that everybody understands the debate at the full level? I don't think that will happen.
So that's a situation kind of like, wow, net neutrality is a big issue, but how the heck do you talk about
it? Exactly. It's very similar to that.
There's
the complexity levels are so great that having a public debate basically means a whole bunch of people that are uninformed talking about it. And I don't know how helpful that is when it comes down to it. So a law mandate does seem like a good idea in the sense that, well, if we did spec out all the different ways of this man-in-the-middle attack type of stuff, you'd come up with a language that theoretically would be codified in law that you could then point to as a reference. At the same time, all that has to be very generic because, of course, technology changes so fast.
Right.
So I'm glad that the event happened at Stanford with, you know, Obama calling for this, because this is exactly what we need. It's just going to be a long, arduous
process. We need more than one of those, it sounds like, to really take care of the problem.
So.
Well, on the general subject of summits and expos and that kind of thing, we heard from friend of the show, Larry Caffiero, this week. He let us know that if you're a Northern California person planning on going to the Southern California Linux Expo, they're offering a 50% off code for registration for NorCal Geeks. The code is NoCal, not NorCal, NoCal, N-O-C-A-L.
Right.
So keep that in mind. And whoever you are, you can find out more about the event at SoCalLinuxExpo.org. That's SoCalLinuxExpo.org. So thanks, Larry, for
that. And you said Larry's a friend of the show?
Yeah, yeah. He was on an episode a while ago. We consider him a Linux geek for the show, though apparently the last time he was on was the February 2nd episode of 2008. So if you're curious about that, you can listen to what he has to say about Linux.
Yeah, and that's the Richard Stallman on Free Software episode, and Larry was on that as well.
Okay.
Good fun show.
Yeah, great. So let's talk about some quick up-and-coming stuff. What's going on? Let's do some rapid-fire
fast stuff. Okay.
Yeah.
Soon you'll be able to take a Disney cruise. You know, so Disney cruises, kind of fun, right?
The
Disney-themed cruises.
If and you're then, into that sort of thing.
Yeah, well, if you've got a family, I've been thinking about it because I got kids and they want to do stuff that I don't exactly want to do. But if we're all
this
shit
well.
Together, you know, it's kind of like hotel.
The sewage system's working.
Exactly,
yeah.
Exactly.
Okay.
So Disney cruises can sometimes be fun. You can go to Alaska and see whatever and be with Disney characters. Cool, fun, whatever. But now, next year, 2016, Disney will release Star Wars Disney-themed cruises.
Ooh. Star Wars is officially over. I have now declared it.
So the Disney characters, of course, Disney now owns the Star Wars franchise, and therefore you can take a cruise ship with all Star Wars theme, which could be a lot of fun.
Could
except
be.
You're sometimes on a boat for a long time, possibly with Jar Jar Binks. But other than that, it could be awesome. So that's coming up in 2016. Also, there's a lot of talk about Apple developing an electric vehicle. It looks like they've got over 100 employees that have been working on electric vehicles.
So that's a real thing?
Yes, yes. It's a real thing. I'm pretty sure that's a real thing. Now, people are saying electric minivan. And the thing is, when you start working on a project, a research project, the actual shape of it is less important than what you're working on. And yes, it's probable that the vehicle is minivan in shape. But then again, if you want to start early, it's going to be big and bulky. You know, Google Glass, when it first started, you had to wear a backpack, right? So like that's just the way the... So I'm not expecting that Google and Apple will release a electric van, minivan. Though I have to say, I'd love an electric minivan because I'm a family man and that would be awesome.
Well, maybe that's their angle. If Google's doing the cute little itty-bitty personal self-driving car, which is just so adorable, you just want to pinch its little cheeks. you know, maybe that's how Apple can kind of stake their territory in the tech
automobile. Talked a couple weeks ago about how much crazy money Apple has, just ungodly amounts of money. So if they're not doing this stuff, what else are they going to do with it, right? Like, you know, when you make $11
might
billion
as well
profit
research
a quarter,
and develop some wacky new items.
Let's make electric car. Anyway, so I'm glad they're doing some research. It's interesting that it's gotten out because Apple's very private about this kind of thing.
Yeah.
You know, people don't even know that they're...
Well, just earlier this last week, it was, you know, rumors of.
Yeah, yeah. It's clear that it's enough rumors is basically the reason why.
Yeah, 100 people is a lot of people to it.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Okay. And more quick stuff. Lindsay, you got something for me?
Sure. Did you know that it was Safer Internet Day on Tuesday?
Was it? Was it, in fact, safer?
Did it feel safe?
Did I feel safer? Let me think back.
I like how everyone's using safer now. I think that's great. So there's a nonprofit that is trying to make the internet safer for everyone, especially youth and vulnerable groups. And they designated Tuesday, February 10th as Safer Internet Day. And in honor of that, Google security blog states that if you do a security checkup on your account before February 17th, they'll give you 2 gigs of data for your Google Drive for free, permanently.
Oh. Mm.
So there's 3 steps. You check your account recovery info, you view recent sign-in activity, and you view the list of apps and devices that have access to your account. And it gives you little green checkboxes for doing these things. And once you've done them, you will get the storage added around February 28th, and they send you a notification once it's added. Hmm. And even if you don't care that much about Google Drive storage, it's still good if you have a Google account to do these things and do them
to
regularly.
To get extra while you can and update
It's a good idea
stuff.
To improve security.
Right.
Yeah. And by the way, they'll give a little bonus.
Right.
That's
exactly.
Cool.
I should look into that.
That's good.
Hmm.
Okay. I'll also post links on geekspeak.org to the Google storage page that shows all your storage broken down by how much is being used where, which I think it's a really cool page.
Awesome.
And I just discovered it recently. So,
all right. So we'll
and
have
then another one that lists suggestions for managing your data and quotas.
All right. So we'll have that at geekspeak.org. Get on awesome. That, Chandler. Okay, great. Two other things I want to get to really quickly. Maybe,
yes.
Maybe
so,
three.
So, well, you just mentioned a special date, and of course today is a special date. It's Valentine's.
It is Valentine's Day.
So
yay.
I thought I'd read some really geeky Valentine's bits.
Yeah, okay.
Okay.
All right. Okay.
So these are tweets of people that are wishing geekiness in Valentine's. I'm attracted to you so strongly, scientists will have to develop a fifth fundamental force.
Oh. Okay, these are geeky.
Yeah, they're really geeky.
Yeah, I get it. Okay.
I won't read the ones you have to actually read because the syntax
some
is there's like
stuff
calculations
here.
But we'll have them up on Geekspeak.
Okay.
Receding objects are red, approaching objects are blue. From my spectral shift, you can calculate that I'm getting closer to you. And there's a lot more, but I won't get into them.
Okay.
They'll
right.
be at geekspeak.org.
All right, so we'll have some of those at geekspeak.org. Let's see, what else did I want to get to? We heard from Matt. Remember the guy? He's a science teacher.
Yes.
And he took our battery bouncing experiment to heart. Well, he's still teaching, apparently, and a little impatient for material. He says, hey, Geekspeak hasn't had a chemistry project we could really get our teeth into this year.
Yeah, a couple years ago, Ben made a story about bouncing a battery to determine if it was full or not. And we thought, that sounds ridiculous. How would that possibly work? And we surmised an idea. And then this chemistry teacher, Matt, who's a high school teacher, said, oh, we'll test that in the class. And he developed an entire project on doing the test. And turns out, yes, batteries bounce differently whether they're full or not.
Yeah.
And you can listen to the Geekspeak episodes to find out how and why that works with Matt as the expert.
Matt as the expert. And he's apparently such a bounding success that he's looking to Geekspeak now to provide his curriculum. I don't know.
We haven't had any, though.
I know.
Stories. I've been thinking
well,
about
he's them. A resourceful fellow. He said, instead, our class is considering a problem we heard on America's Test Kitchen, another sort of scientifically
food
based
geekery is always
show.
Awesome.
Food
sure.
geekery, yeah. So he says, the official recipe for Rice Krispie Treats calls for 283 grams of big marshmallows to add to 6 cups of Rice Krispies. However, if you're using mini marshmallows, the recipe only calls for 188 grams of marshmallows. And the question is, why? So, that is a question now to our listening audience also. We'll collect your thoughts and ideas as you communicate with us. You can write to us at geeks@geekspeak.org or you can tweet us at KUSPGeeks.
Why do you use less small marshmallows than big mushrooms by mass when making Rice Krispie Treats?
Yeah.
Okay. Geeks@geekspeak.org.
Right. And meanwhile, Matt's class will try out their theory. And Matt, we're hoping that you'll give us an update on the findings that your class comes up with. And once again, if you want to communicate with the show, one way you can reach Geekspeak is via Twitter at KUSPGeeks. That's all one word. If you have any questions or comments for us, send us a tweet and we'll respond to tweets today if we get them during the show, or we'll collect them up and respond next week. Another great show on KUSP is the 7th Avenue Project, and this week on the show, The Theory That Changed the Universe, Part 2. They continue the tour of general relativity, Einstein's radical rethinking of space and time. The theory turns 100 this year, and in that segment, you'll hear about some of its weirder implications, including gravity waves, black holes, and the expanding universe. Host Robert Polly talks with theoretical physicist Anthony Aguirre on the 7th Avenue Project. You can hear that Sunday at noon on KUSP or anytime from the talk section of the station's website, kusp.org. Right now you're listening to Geek Speak on KUSP. I'm Bonnie Jean Primsch, and with me in the air room is Lyle Troxell and Lindsay Lonnie. And Lindsay, you've got some geek bits for us, some web extras.
Sure do.
Okay.
Have you heard about the 10 million password dump? Exactly. So on the 9th this week, security researcher Mark Burnett released a torrent file containing more than 10 million passwords that he had compiled from leaked password dumps over the past few years.
Oh, so this is like a hackable, because they have been hacked, passwords to avoid, perhaps.
Right. And so these are not new login password information, but he's compiled a lot of them that have happened over the past few years.
Okay.
And it's a torrent file of 10 million that you can download and look at if you want to.
And what for why would you? What?
So, yeah. That's a little controversial.
Yeah.
But his goal is to raise awareness about having better passwords. And he's hoping that companies will compile lists that of prohibited passwords, so that when you try to create a password, if it's something on this list or something that's recurring on the list, you'll get a warning saying, no, you can't use that one.
Don't do it.
It's risky because someone else got put in jail for doing these things when it was the original leaks.
Uh-huh.
you know, but he's doing this with all information that was already publicly available on the internet. So
he considers himself a white hat.
Right, exactly.
Okay. Got it.
The new thing is that developer Luke Reiman built a simple web interface that lets you search the contents for your own stuff. So don't go out there and put your passwords on a website to search for them, please.
Yeah, okay.
Only use the first, you know, couple of characters and then search through if you want to see if your account information's
on there.
That's
a good tip. All right.
I tried it, and it's a huge, you know, data. It's a lot of data, so it takes a while, and it doesn't always come back with results. Sometimes it just times out, but you can keep trying, and eventually it should work.
That's definitely
all right. So we'll have a link to that thing if people want to search around and see what 10,000 hacked passwords look like.
Right.
Okay. All right. So that'll be at geekspeak.org. And Lyle, you've got a geek bit for
us. Yeah. So Titan, the moon, is liquid, but we want to explore it.
Yeah.
So NASA is developing a project that will launch in 2040. So it's a ways off.
It's a ways off.
That is a submarine for exploring.
What?
Titan. Yeah.
A space submarine?
Space submarine.
20,000 leagues under Titan Sea.
I know.
Yeah, nice.
That's so cool.
So they got some renderings, some designs of how it works. I thought a couple things that are interesting about it. They're planning on having a 1 kilowatt radiothermal Stirling generator to power the thing, which is going to off-gas so much. Titan is really, really cold, like almost cryogenic levels of cold, like really cold. And so it's going to actually be boiling material around its body when it exhausts this stuff. And that's going to help keep the whole thing warm. So I don't know. The whole project looks really fascinating to me.
Yeah, yeah.
And of course, it's going to be a while before it happens. I'm thinking 2040. I might be around still. That's good. That's good. You never know about this kind of stuff.
Right. What if the heat that we create melting stuff creates life on the planet?
It could be. Yeah, we don't want to. I mean, life might already be there, but of course, yeah, very cool. Anyway, so.
Maybe Alcor could. Stake out a little territory on Titan and just freeze their heads there. Remember, that's the company they cryogenically freeze until later.
They just ship the people there.
So you can be a Futurama head in a pod in the future.
Yeah, exactly. Nixon will be hanging out there.
So the renderings and just a little bit of the detail of it is pretty cool. And so I'm
it's got a big fan.
Yeah, it looks like a submarine.
Sweet. And Chandler's getting that up on our website as we speak, so you can check that out. Meanwhile, you know, one thing that we've been talking about on the show is, for gosh sakes, let's get some kill switches going on these phones so that they're less vulnerable to being swiped by other people. And how's that going?
It's going pretty good, actually. So this week was the deadline for manufacturers to comply with, opt-in regulations that say that they have to include kill switches in the phones. And a kill switch is a software kill switch, not a literal switch.
Okay.
That if someone steals your phone, you can turn it off remotely so that they can't access your information. So smartphone theft, basically this was in 2013 that this started, and they had until now to comply. And it looks like most of the manufacturers have complied so far. Apple added a kill switch in September of 2013, and the following year, iPhone theft dropped by 50% in London, 40% in San Francisco, and 25% in New York. So it seems to be having a big effect based on the studies that they're doing. I don't know if there's other things that might have contributed to those numbers, but the article that I'm posting has that information. So police are advocating that laws require kill switch to be installed on all phones, and some want the laws to require that the switch be enabled by default and to not allow consumers to disable it. But so that's a little controversial, whether or not the consumer should have control over whether it's turned on or off. iPhones are the only models that currently come with the feature enabled, and most other manufacturers include a software kill switch, but they're opt-in.
Okay.
So you would need to go on your phone and enable that.
But it sounds like that's a good thing to opt in for because it has an actual beneficial effect.
Right.
Okay.
And even if you don't have something like that installed from the manufacturer, you can usually download an app that does the same thing. Mm-hmm. Some of them are, you know, paid apps that come with antivirus, and some are free. I haven't tried the free ones, but yeah, there's options out there, and it's very useful. And minimizes theft on a grand scale, just that those things exist. So it's
right.
Good.
Huh. It's as effective as the butterfly that looks like the thing that's poisonous. So, you know,
right.
Predators don't go after the poisonous looking butterfly, even though it is not actually poisonous.
Exactly. Yeah, some will even let you wipe your data remotely and take a picture of whoever's holding the phone, which is kind of fun. I haven't tried that.
Nice. Who's got my phone?
Right.
So
just
good.
Get that upshot of someone's nose.
You know, yeah.
What is this?
So, Lyle, my mom got a passport recently, and it had been years and years, and she was surprised to find there was like a little RFID chip in there.
Oh, is there an RFID chip? Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, things have gotten more digital in terms of identification. It sounds like Iowa has taken that one step further, maybe?
Yeah, Iowa is planning on digitizing licenses, driver's licenses. Hmm. The idea would be that you'd install an app on your phone that they created that would be your identification. And it even possibly have some biometric information in it.
So purely digital.
When the police officer
card.
Pulls you over for your, you know, running a red light, they would ask for your identification via your phone. And
who would do that?
Yeah.
Because it's like, here, take my phone. What else would you like to look up and take from there?
That's the thing about, first off, I carry a wallet because not everything I can't do everything on my phone.
Yeah.
I can mostly pay via my phone now, right? I've got the newer iPhone, so there's Apple Pay.
Yeah.
And when I used to have a Google one, I could do Google Pay. But over and over, there's less and less need for things in my wallet. Like, I don't know, most of the businesses that have like these deals where they have our barcode thing that you have to carry with you to get 10% off the groceries or whatever, you can actually put those on your phone, right?
So or you can just give them your phone number.
Or you give them your phone number, which is one way they look it up. But also you can actually do these things where the phone actually has the image of the bar scan that can be scanned from the phone,
right.
depending on the type of scanner. Yeah. In any case, so I do like the idea of lessening what's in my wallet. And the question is a driver's license a good thing to move on to a digital device? I would say eventually as a species, why not?
Yeah.
You can forge a driver's license pretty easily. It's much harder to forge a digital thing.
But Lyle, what problem is a digital driver's license solving for Iowa?
Well, there's a lot of cost involved in printing and dealing with these driver's licenses, right? They're laminated, they're physical things. Of course, also they can get stolen and lost.
Right.
Those things happen. That kind of stuff happens all the time. Mm-hmm. Also, you can relatively, you know, easily artificially create one. And you know, a lot like drivers, insurance for 30 different states actually require that you have proof of digital insurance. Almost all insurance companies actually handle this. This means that the DMV can check to see if you currently are insured.
Yeah.
The piece of paper just allows them to look it up, really.
So if when cop pulls you over,
and
says, "Can I have your insurance, driver's license, and registration?" I'm like, geez, gosh, officer, I can't seem to find my ID card. I'm like, that's all right, lady. I can look you up anyway.
It's a bit like that. It sounds like you've had a lot of conversations like that.
Oh, what?
the problem emerges is if your identity is completely on your phone, even your government-issued identity is on your phone, and they wrote the application, how much do you trust it? So there's a question about that aspect of it. Also, every state does this differently, so it would emerge that maybe I was going to test it first. I like the idea of getting rid of something in my wallet. It seems a little weird that if my phone gets broken or powers down, I don't have identity. That seems a bit of a problem.
Yeah.
It seems like a physical identification thing makes more sense. Maybe we should have barcodes on our skin. No. The truth is the driver's license number is what you need. That's what the police officer actually needs. So you could theoretically just have that. They're going to look you up. They're going to be able to look at your picture anyway. So in some sense, it really is just the number, just like any of these other numbers.
But if you still have just a flip phone or you're not a cell phone person, they still are going to have to print up some physical driver's license.
I would assume there'd be a background. Yeah, there'd be a backup one. But if 90% of the population uses the cell phone thing and they don't use the driver's license physical, then they're going to still save money potentially.
Is it 90% of the population? Our correspondent in Canada, Greg, is saying it seems like it kind of increases the digital divide a bit there.
It does increase the digital divide. Maybe the state would have to start issuing smartphones to people that don't have them.
Well, now we're talking.
And there's all those places that
you
go.
Here's
a
government-issued smartphone. Go ahead and use it however you want.
Yeah, enjoy that.
Just look up whatever you want.
Make sure to plan crimes with it, please.
Here's your crime phone.
What am I going to do when I go to apply somewhere and they want to make a photocopy of my driver's license?
I mean, do you guys deposit checks via your phone?
Yeah.
Okay, I do that. So my bank supports it. What bank do you use?
Wells Fargo,
yeah. All the banks basically are supporting apps on your phone where you can take a photograph of a check and then submit that digital electronically. Because really when you go to an ATM machine and you do it, they just take a photograph of it too. It's not like
that's
they,
really...
Yeah. So that's the same type of thing, right? The phone. My phone is now my depositing capability. I can't write checks with it still. It's kind of frustrating, but we're moving in that direction.
It's next. Mm-hmm. It's next. Checks. Who writes checks?
Exactly. Well, you know, electronic deposit transfers are actually a little hard to do.
Those can or cannot be convenient. My little nonprofit just had a situation with a PayPal payment where, you know, it seems like a convenient way to get money to you, but then one dude who bought some services with us using PayPal went, well, I don't recognize it. He thought it was somebody else, and he questioned the payment, and then it was in limbo for a while, and then the little nonprofit got charged some kind of $20
which is
person fee, which when the money finally went out where it should be in our coffers, we did not get reimbursed for that $20. Right. You're a bad person fee. Well, even though we were no longer a bad person.
See, we haven't figured this all out.
We're still in that awkward teenage phase of tech.
We are.
Yeah.
So Iowa gets to figure out if it makes sense to digitize everybody's driver's license.
Yeah, yeah.
A little scary.
Well, there's also sort of your digital presence after you die. We've all experienced, you know, a death, and then people write tributes on the Facebook page. And then what happens? What happens with a Facebook account after you die?
Well, there's a new feature that helps basically manage the account, so you can designate somebody who can be a legacy contact for you.
That's what I call it.
The terminology they're using is legacy contact.
It's like a trustee or an estate planner, but
yeah.
Different.
I like Facebook executor, FEX for short.
Mm.
I just made
Ooh.
That up. No.
Who's your FEX?
I haven't decided, no. Thursday, they added the option to designate the legacy contact to steward your account after you die. Oh. And to enable the feature, you go to your Facebook settings, security, legacy contact, and then you have the option to send a message to that person. So I'm planning on not telling them.
Or you can just leave
them.
It a secret.
Right. And they won't find out until later. Surprise.
Surprise. Yeah. You have to manage this Facebook account for me now.
Right, exactly. So after Facebook gets notified that you're pushing up daisies, they add remembering above your name on your homepage.
How do they get notified?
Someone has to notify them.
Huh. And could you falsify that notification?
I'm assuming someone's going to try that.
Yeah.
I just don't know what the methods are, because I'm sure that they can check. You know, I'm sure they have, because it's still an archaic. It's not a form you just go fill out. You have to contact them.
It involves a person.
Yeah.
There's humans involved.
So your account says remembering on it. So now it's kind of labeled that this person has passed. Mm-hmm. And then someone gets automatically notified. You have control. And then it acts, I guess, like a Facebook Pages kind of thing, where you're a manager of the page?
Kind of like that.
And does your legacy contact have to be someone you know? Or can you impose, for instance, celebrity legacy contacts?
It's horrible.
Justin Bieber, manage my account.
Oh, yeah, I haven't tried that, but I think it's going to happen.
What, huh?
Who is this?
Yeah, so they basically, it's just really limited what they can do. They can pin a post to the top of your timeline, so things about your services and stuff like that. They can respond to new friend requests, so when people want to go and see your page, they can approve it or not approve it. And they can change the profile picture and the cover photo.
Good.
But
because you don't want forever the person's face to be like,
yeah!
That's good. So it's relatively minimal. It does keep the page kind of stable.
Right.
I think that's a good idea.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I have a few friends who had Facebook pages before they passed away, and visiting them has a continuation of their legacy. It's the same type of thing I did for my father when he passed away. I made a whole website for him with a whole bunch of pictures and let people communicate. Mm-hmm. This is before Facebook was popular enough to do that kind of thing, or trustworthy enough.
Yeah. Right.
I still know if it's trustworthy enough. It's a little weird, but it is de facto personality online, so it does make sense.
Right. Yeah. So go clean up your Facebook page, people.
And not to be outdone, in fact, Facebook is following Google on this. Google has had a thing called Inactive Account Manager for a long time.
Oh.
And an Inactive Account Manager you can set up on any Google account. You have to just search for it, Inactive Account Manager, and you basically designate people that represent you if your account becomes inactive for a certain period of time. And I signed this up a while ago. Of course, designated my wife and also somebody else who will get a notification, my sister, who will get a notification if my account is not used for 6 months. That's the setting I've chosen.
Oh.
And if it hasn't been used for 6 months, they'll get a link. And from that link, they'll be able to download all content of mine and access all account.
Wow.
So basically, it's a complete release of all my account information of Google. And that makes a lot of sense to me. I mean, it's similar to what would happen if, you know, your bank, if you passed away, your next significant other or whatever would be the one responsible for your bank account and your credit cards and all that stuff would kind of, they'd have to manage the close of that. So Google's
making
it.
What if you just go on like some sort of Arctic walkabout for 6 months?
Yeah, I'll be offline for 6 months. Yeah, I'm sure that'll happen.
Yeah, it could happen.
I think you might be able to choose other durations.
You haven't had your midlife
crisis, I
believe.
Oh, really?
Well, it could, you know.
I wear
Google
Glass a lot.
You know, when you're extreme in one direction, sometimes
it's true.
The pendulum swings the other way.
You can change up to 18 months.
Okay.
But also, if the person's trustworthy, they don't have to actually they don't have to click on the link, right? So theoretically, you could set it to a shorter period, and actually the email would just come out and say, we haven't seen Lyle in a while. Do you want to take over their account? And my sister or wife would
like,
be like,
it's just an Arctic walkabout. It's cool.
Which I like Arctic walkabout.
Arctic.
Sounds cold, though.
I was going to go on walkabout.
Do it while you still can.
Yeah,
so that's called, in Google, that's called Inactive Account Manager. You get it through account settings.
Lindsay, I consider you sort of our wearable tech correspondent
Oh, really?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's a topic that you and I have talked about quite a bit on the show. And it sounds like you found another one that may be useful for reducing stress. That seems to be a theme this year, is people looking at stress and how to reduce it.
Yep, because we're learning how bad it really is
for us. Yeah. Well, it's like we sort of like rolled into 2015 kind of hoping it would all just go away, but we're still stressed out. That's weird.
Yeah, so at CES last year, a company called Think, THYNC, demoed a wearable device that claims to reduce stress or increase energy using mini electric pulses that are controlled by your smartphone. And if you've ever gone to physical therapy or used a TENS machine, you kind of get how this works.
Okay.
Just alternating electrical current, and you can control how strong it is. And it, you know, it has been proven to help with pain and other things, muscle tension. What this company has done is they have neuroscientists and a lot of scientific information about the brain and brain studies, and they targeted certain nerve areas that control stress response feedback.
Mm-hmm.
And so by targeting these areas, when you have a stress response, there are certain biomarkers like saliva, salivary enzymes, and certain neurological activity that say this person's stressed out. And they did a study with, you know, half people using this and half people using a sham version of this, and studied their saliva enzymes and their neurological markers, and found that it actually does help reduce stress.
Okay.
And so even though that happened last year, the study showing that it does actually reduce stress signs came out this week, so that's why I'm mentioning it now.
I see. Okay.
You know, it's
the studies
kinda,
are in.
I don't think it's like a new era thing yet, where you can throw away all your medications and pills for stress.
Hooray!
And whatever you're doing.
Yeah.
But I find it interesting.
Continue attack on all levels.
Yeah, I definitely want to see more studies where its effects are compared to things like, you know, stretching, massage, you know, acupuncture, and medications, instead of just a blind one against a sham.
Mm-hmm.
But and there's also no research showing what effects long-term or frequent use could yield, so we need to know more about it. But it's interesting.
Okay. Huh. It's Geek Speak on 88.9 KUSP and KUSP.org. I'm Bonnie Jean Primsch with Lindsay Lonnie and Lyle Troxell. And Lyle, something today that I noticed is that more and more devices are using USB, so we're like relying on other devices to power up our devices.
It's true. We're very reliant on energy in our world.
We
electrical
are.
Energy mostly.
So let's talk about energy, because it seems like we're using more and more of it as we go in more and more digital, but where is it all going to come from?
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that occurs to me when we hear about alternative energy sources in general, people seem to collude the idea of an energy source and an energy transportation. And so I wanted to clarify the difference between those things. So on planet Earth, we basically...
Wait. An energy source and an energy what?
Distribution.
Delivery, okay.
Distribution.
Yeah, got it.
So a mechanism for transporting it, basically.
Got it.
So we basically only
have
two serious energy sources on the planet Earth. We have sunshine and we have thermonuclear. Everything else is basically derived from those.
Oh.
We do have...
Wind power is derived from thermonuclear?
No, wind power is derived from sunshine, right? So the sunshine beats on the Earth.
Oh,
it causes storms to occur. Wind comes from that.
I see. Yeah.
So basically the source is the sun.
Okay.
And
same thing for like hydroelectric?
Hydroelectric, yeah. The great story about hydroelectric, of course, this is throwing water past a blade that causes rotation, which generates electricity.
Yeah.
That's hydroelectric dams.
Uh-huh.
The way that actually works is the sun evaporates water. It causes it to a gas. It heats it. It becomes lower density. It rises. As it cools, it becomes higher density and it falls. That potential energy then becomes rain.
I
so the sunshine gets converted to potential energy. We use that potential energy to power hydro dams.
Okay, I get it now. All right.
And so all of these things kind of derive that way.
Yeah.
Another example of this would be the wind energy, hydrocarbons. So
hydrocarbons.
Petrol.
Petrochemical.
Products. Yeah, petrochemical.
Yeah.
These are produced part... let me just back up 1 second and just say there's two other energy sources on Earth. There's gravitational, so the moon produces waves.
Okay.
That's another energy source. The moon is slowing down because of its drag on our tidal systems.
Uh-huh.
And as it slows down, it gets farther away. So the moon will never be closer than it is right now. It's always going away, I think, an inch every 10 years, something crazy like that.
Oh, wow.
So in any case...
Doesn't like us anymore.
So that's another energy source,
okay.
Right? Doesn't like us.
Mm.
It's too attractive to us.
So it sounds like
the
two main
sources... And then the last one is geothermic,
sources.
Right? So you could actually have lava, the heats of that nature are because of our heat of the planet. It's been surmised, basically, that energy source is partially comes from gravitational fluctuations, but also it comes from radiation, from materials breaking down in our system. That's why the Earth isn't a solid rock at this point. It's because there's extra heat in there from radiation of materials, minerals being radiated. And then, of course, the hydrocarbons. Let me get back to that one. So those are all the energy sources, the four of them, basically.
Okay.
And then hydrocarbons are petroleum products I want to talk about, are formerly plant material that got squished, right? That's the general thought of how it works. At the same time, it might not be the case, so that's the theory. But it's a pretty well-held theory. So that becomes from plants. Plants, of course, gets all the energy from sunshine. Mm-hmm. And here you go. Sun, again, is really important.
Okay. Huh.
So when people talk about, like, the hydrogen economy, they talk about cars that are running on hydrogen.
Right.
Hydrogen is an amazingly good transportation mechanism, but it's not a source of energy. So
it's a distribution method?
Yeah, it's a distribution method.
Huh.
So you can take electricity and heat up, if you will, or break up water into hydrogen and oxygen, and then you can take that hydrogen and use it later on. But that's basically like a chemical battery. It's a process that is really more like a battery. It's a storage mechanism. You have to get the energy from somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
So the trick is where you get the energy from, and the sun seems like a good source to me. Thermonuclear is also potentially nice. But in any case, some researchers at Harvard, Joseph Torelli and Christopher Gallaridi, have developed what they're calling an artificial leaf. And this is a catalyst system to make sunlight split into water and into hydrogen, the hydrogen and oxygen, as we said before. But instead of going right from that stage and taking hydrogen, compressing it, and having to deal with this high-pressured hydrogen gas or liquid hydrogen, instead they have a bacterium that they've engineered to convert carbon dioxide plus hydrogen into a hydrocarbon, isopropanol. And isopropanol is one of the, it's an alcohol. It's a hydrocarbon. It's basically something you could then later burn.
Yeah.
Gasoline is like this as well.
Okay.
So isopropanol alcohol is only 24 megajoules per kilogram, which is half of gasoline. So it's actually still pretty good as a storage medium. And it doesn't have to be held under high pressure. So the idea of going from water, basically, with a bacterial and sunshine into a form of alcohol that you could then burn is very convenient because, as it turns out, storing electricity in chemical storage is difficult at best.
There's some loss there, right?
There's a little bit of loss, yeah.
It's like having a copy of a copy of a copy.
That's right. We also have an amazingly large infrastructure on combustibles, on burning things. Mm-hmm. Most cars, of course, are that way. And planes, of course, are as well, use mm-hmm. burning mm-hmm. to actually power them.
So they talked about taking garbage and turning it into usable energy by burning it at the right temperature.
Yes.
Whether it's junk mail or tires.
Those anything
different
that can burn, you can basically do this with.
Yeah.
So I just thought it was interesting that they've got a process in place to transfer sunlight plus water mm-hmm. into an alcohol that you could potentially burn. Very nice. It would be nice to see this in large mass. And another example of hydrogen probably will always be the energy transport of the future. It'll always be something we don't really do because it probably will achieve other methods of energy transfer that are more efficient than hydrogen. At the same time, we're working on hydrogen technology as well for transportation.
Okay.
So to sum up all of this, cool story about using bacteria to catalyst water into isopropyl alcohol.
Uh-huh.
And other is think about energy sources, not energy transportation, when you think about where energy comes from. The source is really important because without thinking about the source, you don't know if it's continual or not.
Right. Okay. Mm-hmm. And so that can help with the debate about, you know, which power source should I use because how expensive or costly energy loss wise is the distribution system.
Yeah. And how repetitive, you know, how long can you continue using
it?
Yeah.
Interesting.
Cool.
Interesting. All right. So earlier I said we should talk more about phone stuff.
Mm-hmm.
One thing that's been annoying is just not being able to have your phone unlocked. You can have your way with it. But it sounds like things might be changing around that.
Yep. February 11th was the final deadline for mobile carrier compliance with the phone unlocking guidelines in the Consumer Code for Wireless Service, which was updated in 2013. So unlocking a phone allows it to be used on any compatible network, regardless of carrier. And previously, carriers would lock the phones, you'd pay all this money for your phone, end of your contract.
Mm-hmm.
The only thing you could do with your phone is either continue another contract with that phone with the same carrier or sell it to someone else at the same carrier and have it transferred. You couldn't go to a different carrier overseas or, you know, whatever.
Now, that's been loosening up a little bit over time, hasn't it?
Yeah. There's been a lot of upset about that because, you know, a smartphone is kind of like a computer. computer and you pay a lot of money for it. Mm-hmm. And at the end of your contract, if you don't want to be with that carrier anymore, it was useless. And people were like, well, I bought this computer. It should be mine.
Yeah.
You know?
Right. Yeah.
So this has been a progress, but the deadline happened on the 11th. And so
did people make the deadline?
Right.
Did it work?
Yeah. As soon as your contract term is fulfilled and you don't owe a carrier money, mm-hmm. U.S. carriers must unlock the phone within 2 days of you requesting it. Mm. So some of them do it automatically. Sometimes the phones are, some carriers are already unlocking the phones. But this mandate states that if you are done with your contract and you don't owe the carrier money, you can request it. Because before, you could request it, but you wouldn't know if they would do it or not. They didn't really have to. Now they have to do it within 2 days of you requesting it.
Ooh, that's power. Yeah. It's consumer power. Do my bidding, big company.
There's some other stuff that has been mandated about that. So carriers also have to post unlocking policies on their websites in clear language. And so, you know, there's links in the article that's going to be up there to those policies on the different carriers' pages. And then you can use it on any compatible network or go to an MVNO, which is a reseller, and, you know, get a better deal on price, different things like that once mm-hmm. you're done with your contract.
Huh. Okay. Maybe we should talk about another kind of locking, too. It's been sort of an annoying thing for any creator of a thing. Someone else will come along and reverse engineer it and make their, you know, knockoff version of that thing.
Yeah. So I don't know if you've heard of software HARES, H-A-R-E-S. It's Hardened Anti-Reverse Engineering System.
No.
New thing that's going to be demoed pretty soon in Singapore. But the HARES is an encryption tool for software that doesn't allow the code to be decrypted until the last possible moment before it's executed.
What?
So,
wait, say that again.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. So,
wait, could you just say that sentence again?
Sure. Encryption tool for software that doesn't allow the code to be decrypted, the software code, to be decrypted until the last possible moment before the code is executed. So, you know, when you double click on your icon on your computer, you're executing computer code
to
open a program.
It's like having it be embargoed until its release.
Yeah, until that moment. So that makes it much harder. Basically, the purpose is to make applications as opaque as possible to malicious hackers who are trying to find vulnerabilities and exploits. Hmm. So, you know, while your computer is doing its thing, if there's malware, it's going to be hammering away at your programs looking for exploits. And this can help prevent some of that. Mm-hmm. To keep reverse engineering tools in the dark, so there's a lot of reverse engineering tools for software.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and one question I have about this, Lindsay, is sort of how does that fall into the desire for more transparency in some circles? Is this at odds with that? Or is the fact that it is no longer encrypted when it's released mean that... Tell me more about that.
Basically, it can be used both ways. So this is sort of a white hat thing where this is being released. I'll give you a little more information about it. The translation look-aside buffer has a split. It's used on Intel and AMD chips on your computer. And the split segregates the portion of a computer's memory where a program stores the data from the portion where it stores its own code instructions.
Oh, so they're in two different places.
Right,
okay.
Exactly.
And that helps.
So this keeps everything in the instructions portion of memory encrypted while the program is not running.
Okay.
And it can only be decrypted with a key that resides in the computer's processor. So
it has to be kind of green lit by the actual maker.
Right, and the sophisticated tricks like a cold boot attack, which some malicious software uses, freeze the data in a computer's RAM and then parses it.
Wait. What's a cold... What?
A cold boot attack, basically, it's a malicious software tool technique that grabs everything that's in RAM at that moment.
Okay.
So if you were encrypting software and the key was there in the RAM, uh-huh. then it could use that decryption key to then reverse engineer the program.
Okay, I think I'm getting this.
But what this does is it stores the key in the processor and not in the memory.
Oh, cool.
So even if it's attempting to grab the key, it can't do that because the key is not there.
It's like how viruses live in your spine and you can't actually get rid of them.
It does feel a little bit like, what is the subvirus, the things that, that mad cow disease is one of those. It sounds like that level of, it works differently than most programs would run, right? It's mm-hmm. it's actually existing
it's
in
different enough.
Yeah, a higher level state in the processor yeah. than in the memory space. That's pretty cool.
Huh.
Yeah, you know, hackers could also use it when creating the malware, so we can't reverse engineer the malware too. So it works on two levels.
Oh, it's the cat and mouse game continues.
Right, exactly. So I'm imagining the beginning of like the itchy and scratchy thing where yeah. they bust out guns that are
they
bigger
just
and
have
bigger
another
and bigger
weapon
and
to
who
use
has the bigger one faster. Yeah. You know, okay. it's definitely one of those things, but it will for a while put a damper on malware, at least older versions of malware, reverse engineering the programs on your computer to look for vulnerabilities.
Hmm. Wow, crazy.
Yeah, right?
Boy, it's just going to continue and get more and more obtuse and harder to have public conversations about.
Right.
Just to circle back to that topic. Well, all right, so that's it. That's the end of the show. Thanks for listening to Geek Speak this week. It is a registered service mark of David Lawrence. Geek Speak is that term and is used with permission. And Geek Speak is Creative Commons Attribution 3.0, which means please use our stuff. Just cite your sources, man. This is public radio for the Central Coast, 88.9 KUSP Santa Cruz, live online at KUSP.org. To find out more about this or any episode of Geek Speak, please do visit us at geekspeak.org. Also, keep in mind you can email us at geeks@geekspeak.org. Contact us on Twitter. We're at KUSPGeeks. We'd love to take your comments and questions and use them on the air for future shows. Today's theme song was by Michael Newman of Pet Star Music. I'm Bonnie Jean Primsch with Lyle Troxell and Lindsay Lonnie. Thanks to our intern, Chandler. And thank you for being here for our February 14th, 2015 episode of Geek Speak.